Hey everyone, welcome back to another episode of Critical Moves. Today we have a very special and exciting guest on our show, Ben Angle. Am I pronouncing that right?
Angel,
all right. And he's a wonderful dev on the new Age of Empires DLC, Chronicles, and involved with the campaign, story, level design. Is that correct?
That's right, yes. Quite a wide brief.
And Jack, of course, our lovely, amazing co-host of Critical Moves podcast.
Thank you.
All right. I have to say, Ben, Age of Empires, one of my all-time favorite and most played video game of all time. Do you like it? Do you like Age of Empires? Is that fun for you?
Yes, I think Age of Empires 2 is my go-to answer for favorite video game of all time. It was Age of Empires 1 at the age of about 6 that was really my first PC strategy game experience. So I suppose I have my entire career to owe to that game.
Yeah, no, I think the listeners would be excited to have a little bit of inside view on how the design went, the story, what approach you took, and so on. I feel like, personally, RTS is a difficult medium for story. I know some people feel differently about it, but you're kind of far away from the characters. It's very abstract, you know, if you think of something like a barracks or a house or something like that. Everything is very abstracted. Whereas in a story, you want to be close to the characters, you want to see character motivation and so on. And I think some of RTSs have done it really well and some have done it really poorly or focused entirely on different aspects. How have you experienced that, being part of the design of it?
You've hit on some interesting things there. Obviously, I'm the narrative lead, and my previous job was as a game writer at Ubisoft. So narrative and story and characters is very much my thing. And it was my passion right from the start of the Chronicles project to make this a really narrative-focused experience. But you're right, there are inherent challenges to doing that in the RTS genre. You can't see people's faces. Well, certainly in Age of Empires, they don't animate, they don't talk to each other. You don't have these naturalistic dialogue exchanges. Everything is sort of from this zoomed-out perspective. But on the other hand, that presents interesting opportunities because you can basically have characters talking to each other and it's like a radio play that's going on while you're playing the game. And one of my bugbears with modern narrative games actually is just how much time it takes you away from the gameplay and you have to watch a cutscene and the story is delivered to you, and then you get a bit of gameplay and then you're going to sit down for another half hour cutscene. With RTS, it can just be going on in the background because it doesn't matter physically where you are because you've got this omnipotent perspective. And we can do some wonderful sort of stylized things with that. Like we have Alexander the Great and the king of Persia, Darius, sort of trash talking each other. Obviously, how does that actually work? Physically, they're miles apart in this scenario, but because of the convention of RTS, we can have them having the slanging match. It's fantastic. The other thing you brought up, where you say, yeah, like a barracks, and they're identical. You know, you can make a number of identical barracks, pre-rendered isometric graphics. They all look exactly the same. The job of a writer, of a narrative designer in the strategy game sphere, I think, is a lot about giving specificity to this generic setup. So, for example, the first Chronicles DLC, Battle for Greece, in the second mission, you've got to guard these supply convoys that are coming in to supply this fleet that you're building. And every time it comes in, there's a voice line, but it won't just simply say, you know, another supply cart has arrived, which is what has actually happened. It's just a donkey cart every time. They'll talk about, you know, arrows fletched with the feathers of eagles, or, you know, sharp swords or akinakai, and all these very specific things. And that's what you've got to do as a narrative designer, put that specificity into what is not actually really there in the game. Create that.
Fascinating. Yeah, and I think a lot of RTSs have done that correctly, and I think a few come to mind for probably for both of us. But then I also remember level designs being really difficult, I think, for some RTS designers when they've had this repeated scenario. Basically, you start with a couple of builders, you make a base, you build up, and then you send over to the other side of the map and you defeat the enemy, and have made campaigns feel very repetitive, monotonous, and unfun, basically, to be honest. Jack, would you say this was the case with your experience playing Chronicles?
No, I'm glad you asked me this because it's interesting. The game did not feel that repetitive. It was clearly a situation where from the first scenario of this campaign, you're already witnessing the midst of a larger battle between Philip and his army and his allies. And then they give you the reins of Alexander and they ask you to do exactly what Alexander needed to do at that point in history. What was interesting to me about that was that in the second scenario as well, they start to introduce more of like there wasn't already a base here. Let's introduce the core Age of Empires 2 loop. But they still do things that are restricting, right? So like, I think the real excitement of something like this, or what's so intriguing about seeing somebody develop a DLC for Age of Empires 2 this late into the game, is that Ben and his team clearly looked at the very common gameplay loop of Age of Empires that everybody knows and has been addicted to. And then they chose when to allow that gameplay loop to take precedence, and then also when to limit it, and then designed their narrative not just around what already existed for Age of Empires, but essentially it's like instead of expanding on exactly what Age of Empires needed to do as a gameplay loop, they developed their narrative and then started limiting what Age of Empires let you do. And for a lot of games that try to do that, it doesn't work. It just feels like they're restricting you from doing the things that you like doing. But in this game, this DLC, it made it feel like it was specific to the scenarios. Like in the second scenario that I mentioned, there wasn't a base. You start building one. I was so inclined when they gave me all the villagers to just try to like build a barracks and protect myself, but they didn't let you build anything. And it made sense, right? You're like in the midst of an ambush. So.
Yeah, I would say me, myself, being a multiplayer-focused game and loving Age of Empires 2 in a multiplayer version of it, I felt a lot of fellow players who are PvP players to complain about campaigns where like, oh, this is not challenging enough or something like that. But I'm so happy you focused on narrative, because something I've said before, I think narrative is a driving force of a single-player campaign, to feel involved, to feel connected to the characters. And you could, I don't know if you played Stronghold Crusader Extreme. It was like a single player campaign that had no story whatsoever, and it was all like basically challenges to overcome, like one scenario after the other. And it was like a bunch of challenges of like really difficult missions. And I think that's like a very good multiplayer focused content, but I wouldn't mix the two. And I'm really happy you went with something very narrative focused. And I think the majority of the players enjoyed that over anything else. Is that what your metrics showed as well?
Yeah, it's been terrifically well received. Both DLCs sitting at very positive on Steam. And yeah, I think you do have to focus in on what you want your audience to be. Age of Empires already has 50 civs that you can play in ranked multiplayer. And obviously this is set in a completely different era. So right from the start, we knew we weren't designing this for competitive multiplayer so much. And we also knew from the data, from the metrics, that there are loads and loads of people that absolutely love campaigns. And as a personal feeling, I think that current gaming landscape is somewhat underserved for strong, especially linear single-player narrative campaigns, not just in the RTS genre, in FPS, my other favorite genre. The days of sort of Half-Life and Bioshock seem very far away. So definitely we wanted to provide that, and people have really enjoyed it. To pick back up on some things that Jack was saying, Yeah, certainly one thing is narrative through gameplay. That's something that's very important to me. We could have just had a series of basically skirmish matches with a little narrative wrapper on top. Would have been fine. Could have had some nice dialogue. But what's the point? It's a video game. You should experience the story for yourself. Otherwise, you're wasting the medium. So yeah, we have at the start of the Alexander the Campaign, where the story is that Alexander is still a prince, he's still serving under his father, and he's kind of chafing against this authority. He wants to win glory for himself. Well, how do we make the player feel that? Well, we somewhat restrict them. In those first three scenarios, you're playing a subordinate role to King Philip and his generals. And then you get into the fourth scenario where he's actually the king, and it's this huge, very long, quite chaotic, quite difficult scenario. And again, it makes you feel the pressures of kingship being suddenly thrust upon you. So trying to match up gameplay and narrative is something that we always try to do. But also changing up gameplay between levels is something that I think is very important. It's not good enough, I think, in 2025 to just have a campaign that's a series of skirmish matches on a nice pre-made map. So we have things like there's a sort of city builder level where it completely changes the gameplay so that you're placing these districts as if you're in a city builder. We have that one with the moving base. In Battle for Greece, we had one where you play as a politician and your goal is to get re-elected each year, not to go out and defeat the enemy. I love games that do that, you know, not just in the RTS genre. You look at something like the Titanfall 2 campaign, where like one level they just introduced a time travel mechanic just for that level, just to move it up. Why not?
Yeah, absolutely. And I remember I used to make maps a lot in RTS in like the 2000s. And I had difficulty with Age of Empires 2 map editor at the time, because it was not at all open to that kind of thing, like hero units and so on, and the triggers that you could use. And then I remember Warcraft 3 very much did have that, and you could play around with it so much. But a big issue I see with that is like, how much effort does it take to make that? Like, and I can imagine with Chronicles, you must have had so much more patience and time and money probably to make all that. So it would have been much easier to just make a series of skirmish matches or something like that. So how much leeway did you have with that? How much freedom did you have to extend maybe development time for it?
Well, we are blessed with a team of really fantastic designers. And the fact that the game has been around since 1999 means that we have people who do have decades of experience in the editor. They know all sorts of tricks. So, you know, they are able to pull off extraordinary things. But yes, it is far more time intensive than just doing a series of skirmishes. The tools that we're using, some people think, you know, we have special dev tools. We don't. The majority of our work is done with the same scenario editor, which has been being built on since 1999. And yeah, you'll have experienced it. It is cumbersome, and you do need to sort of bend it to your will sometimes. Mm. So in every scenario, we kind of have to do a sort of cost-benefit analysis and try and predict, okay, how tricky is this one going to be to create? How many bugs are going to come out on the other end? Is it worth putting that much effort to get something out the other side? And we don't always predict that correctly. Sometimes scenarios prove to be far more intensive than we predicted. But, you know, we're honing our prediction abilities with more experience all the time.
I have another question. How do you feel about history, about a game like that, in parts to teach history, but at the same time, you probably don't want to be too confined to it as well. And you want to tell a nice story, and perhaps changing the story a little bit to make it a more compelling story can be interesting for the viewer as well, or the player rather in this case. So how is that? How's the decision-making process in that with accuracy, with storytelling, and so on?
Well, I have a PhD in ancient history, so I sort of have the last word on that. Okay. And generally, I think it's reasonable that if I'm satisfied with the historical accuracy of something, I think that's a decent enough metric. But yes, I don't go for historical accuracy. I go for historical authenticity is the word I prefer to use. Because if you went for strict accuracy, you wouldn't create an interesting game. The Battle of Salamis, for example, was just a bunch of ships ramming into each other in reality. But to adapt that to Age of Empires, you have to be able to build docks and create ships out of them. It's not how a battle works. So right from the start, the fact that you're adapting this to this medium means that you have to alter how history really worked. And people also don't realize just how thin our sources are. Alexander the Great, for example, you know, all the sources are written hundreds of years after his death. There are massive gaps in the sources. So, you know, what were some of these personalities and people like? We've got nothing. So you have to make it up. So my general rule is try not to contradict the sources, but there are so many gaps that we can use our imagination to sort of fill those in. And like I say, I want the result to be something that feels authentic, that really engages with the history and that feels like it could be true and that tries to get to the essence of history. But if you try to slavishly tie yourself to historical accuracy in every single aspect, you're going to come up with something that's simply, one, not fun, and two, I mean, there are so many gaps, you have to make stuff up.
That's interesting. Yeah. Yeah, no, absolutely. And then when it comes to morals and so on, how do you feel about putting people in front of decisions that people at the time would have made versus as a mirror to present day morals and questions and choices?
That's an interesting one. There is often a tendency, particularly in popularizing history, to try to, oh, the ancients were just like us, and to try and draw analogies between the modern and the ancient world and try and make it all very understandable to us in modern terms. I think it's much more interesting to recognize the ancient world for what it was, which was a very different and very strange place. So with Chronicles, we try and sort of approach value system rather than a modern one. So yeah, you know, you'll be committing slaughters and doing all sorts of terrible things. We don't shy away from that. And the way that the characters think about the world is very ancient. All of the characters are religious, as it were. You know, they all believe in the ancient gods. Even the, you know, baddie characters, they all believe in the gods. They propitiate the gods. They think about things like honor, things that are much more prevalent in ancient society than in modern societies. They all have, you know, the Iliad as a point of reference that they're constantly thinking back to. I think it's much more interesting to sort of try and create a story within the ancient value system than a modern story. And I also sort of play with that sometimes. So the start of the Alexander the Great campaign, where, you know, Alexander's sort of going, oh, you know, why doesn't my father take me seriously? I want to go and win glory. It sounds like it's going to be kind of modern Disney story, right? Like, you've heard this story before. That's what you think is going to happen. But then it turns out to be something darker and stranger. And in fact, it's a Sophoclean tragedy that it ends up being.
Was there a debate on using Age of Empires 1 versus Age of Empires 2?
Not really, because the origins of this are in a mod, actually, called Rome at War for Age of Empires 2, which was a total overhaul mod, you might call it, taking the core gameplay of Age of Empires 2 and adapting the visuals for the ancient world. So this caught on, it got very popular. World's Edge, who run the Age of Empires franchise, spotted this and then got the team behind that mod to team up with the company Capture Age, and then hiring a bunch of people, including me. And that's how Chronicles got going. So it was always going to be done that way. There are certain things about Age of Empires 2 that are, I think, just very clearly advancements on Age of Empires 1, which, as much as I love it, it's so dear to my heart, Age of Empires 1, it is a very archaic game these days. Mm-hmm. So Age of Empires 2 was much better suited to creating what we wanted to do.
I don't know if you can answer this question or if this is a bit too controversial, but then why not Age of Empires 4?
Again, it was because the mod already existed for Age of Empires 2. A lot of our team are Age of Empires 2 community members, people with massive experience in the scenario editor for Age of Empires 2. I don't know how much of a custom campaign community exists for Age of Empires 4, I have to say. I like Age of Empires 4. It's a solid game, but I'm not deeply in touch with community content for that. It's a relatively recent game, so you know, I suspect that the community certainly isn't as large and the expertise isn't as deep as what was available for Age of Empires 2. And you know, Age of Empires 4 is not a replacement of Age of Empires 2. These two games are being supported simultaneously by different studios. So, you know, this was AOE2 content.
Would you want to be involved with a hypothetical Age of Empires 5?
Yes, absolutely. I can't give you any juicy insights into that because I can honestly say I know absolutely nothing about what goes on in World's Edge Towers. But of course, whatever comes next in the Age of Empires franchise, I love this series so much that I'm keen to be there and to be the voice advocating for strong narrative-driven content particularly.
And your interest lies especially in the ancient area?
Obviously, with a PhD in that area, it's slightly unavoidable. And my previous job, I spent a lot of time working on the recently released Anno 117 at Ubisoft, another game set in the ancient world. So that's certainly been my niche so far, but my interests are very broad. And certainly in my writing, this sort of grand, epic, ancient stuff isn't necessarily my go-to. Modern British dark humor is much more my forte, actually. So I have great ambitions personally, so I will not be creating ancient strategy content for my entire career, I suspect.
I feel like it's still yet a very underutilized era. I don't know, Jack, if you've played a lot of like Greek or Roman timed games. I can think of a few.
No, it's been a point of mine to try to focus on it. I think just in general, right? Like stereotypically, I'm one of those people that wouldn't necessarily be captured by that immensely. Not because I don't find history interesting, but because the understanding of how that was supposed to be captured and like distilled for an RTS game or even like a turn-based game. And so the interesting thing to me is, outside of the narrative, I find the aesthetic, the limitations of the time period and the way it influences like the units and designs and everything for a game, that stuff always captures me. So playing Anno 1800 was a delight. Playing Civ is always a delight, but especially playing things like really just any city builder that has that aesthetic or time period with those limitations, general strategy games in that way is interesting. But as far as narrative, it never, like I make a point to focus on modern science fiction or like the way people adapt larger franchises in those ways, not to just play the same sequels over and over again, but to like, we did an episode on it before, like when franchises try to dip into strategy, I always find those things seemingly more enticing than like an ancient narrative. But I think what really spoke to me about this DLC beyond, you know, feeling like I should play it for this interview was that I had recently already looked into far more of my misunderstandings of Alexander the Great, the things that I didn't understand about his campaign through Persia and his life at large. So it was really intriguing to me because having recently learned more about those things, I was excited that I now had the opportunity for this to actually like see which direction the Chronicles took it and how they basically how they exemplified his entire career of just insane military feats as a Age of Empires 2 scenario.
Did you have any, how can I put this? Did you have any directions, personal feelings towards, for example, portraying Alexander the Great's sexuality, for example? Did you say, oh, you can do this, you can't do this, or I want to do this, or I don't want to do this, or the focus thereof? Because I would say Alexander is such a... can be made as such an example in that sense for a lot of people that might feel like they don't have a lot of great examples.
I think firstly, it's often it's slightly limiting the genre that we're working in with what you can show, because it's all military stuff. Every scenario has to depict military matters, and so some of the fascinating things that Alexander did, if there was no fighting involved, we can't adapt it to an Age of Empires scenario. So a lot of the sort of personal incidents get put into cutscenes, or they don't get mentioned at all. With Alexander's sexuality, much debated topic, because like many aspects of Alexander, we simply don't have any definitive answers about this. There's his relationship to Hephaestion, which I think a lot of people today have got it into their heads that they were definitely in a sexual relationship. There's not any evidence for that, actually. The passage that was most interesting to me about Alexander's sexuality that I drew on most was in Plutarch, who there's a passage where he's sort of talking about Alexander's sexuality, and it's a bit like Alexander's relationship. He says with Alexander, you know, he didn't actually drink as much. He was actually, you know, very temperate, very abstinent. Same with sex. That was Plutarch's sort of view of him. And you kind of get this sense of a guy who's a bit weird about sex. Like, it's not really a thing for him. It's almost conquest, glory, that satisfies any urges. So I thought that would be an interesting thing to actually channel somewhat. Sort of, he's kind of above this mortal rutting with other physical humans. And actually, there was another character, a comparable character that I had in my mind when I was coming up with Alexander. There's a wonderful film called The Bounty with Anthony Hopkins about the mutiny on the Bounty. And the captain of the Bounty, William Bligh, as portrayed by Anthony Hopkins in that film, is also a bit weird about sex. Like the rest of his men, they land on this exotic tropical island and his men are fornicating with the locals. And Anthony Hopkins is sort of weirdly removed. You know, we should be doing our duty. I care only about military matters. And there was a lot of other aspects of that William Bligh portrayal that I put into Alexander, and that sort of seeped in as well. But nonetheless, I think if you look through the writing, his relationship with Hephaestion in this campaign is very ambiguous. It's deliberately ambiguous. You can read it either way. Are they just devoted friends, or are they lovers? And Hephaestion's role in this campaign is less to be Alexander's lover as to be his disciple, to be his devotee. His role is to really bring out Alexander's most grandiose ambitions and pretensions. Every step of the way, he is a voice encouraging Alexander on to further greatness. And so, you know, it was just more a matter of going for different aspects of characters than that one.
That seems absolutely fair. You mentioned Anno 117. Personally, I don't know you, Jack, I'm incredibly excited about playing that. Set in Roman times as well. I don't know. I feel very conflicted about it. In one sense, like, I'm super excited for a new Anno game, obviously. But then, of course, when it comes to narrative, which, you know, you talk about, and then the Anno series, and then the time periods, the Roman time period, it's not a time period of, like, let's sail around and find explorative islands to settle and so on. It feels like a very different era than the previous Anno games. How do you feel about that? And how do you feel about, like, maybe worrying that the time period is not represented as well in the Anno game?
Anno's approach to history has always been Asterix and Obelix history, you might say. It sort of takes history and sort of makes a joke out of it, right?
Yeah.
And it's got that cute tone. It's delightful. It's fun. Sometimes it struggles to take itself seriously because everything has to be joke. But I think Anno's an example of a game where they've got a fantastic core formula. You know, that's core gameplay loop is so addictive and so fun and so satisfying. They don't adapt it to the different periods. They just sort of, yeah, it's kind of a Roman skin on a formula that works really well. As for things like the islands, I think you can kind of accept that. It's not meant to be a representation of our world, I don't think. It's almost kind of like the Anno world, where everything is just islands. Why is it like that? Because that's what works for the gameplay. But I, you know, I think you can buy into the fiction, accept that. I haven't yet played 117 myself. Maybe I'll wait for it to go on sale rather than giving Ubisoft full price. But, you know, a lot of my old colleagues I'm still in touch with, you know, proud of their work. And so, yeah, my congratulations to them because I know they worked very hard on it.
Jack, do you have any games you're thinking of you would like Ben to develop a story-driven campaign for?
That's a good question. Well, like I said before, a lot of the games that could feature a DLC where Ben would be like best utilized with his experience of Age of Empires 2, his ancient history PhD, I feel like I haven't experienced the narratives they already have to offer, or I haven't pursued those. So it's really just the world is Ben's oyster. Like he said, he doesn't think he'll be in ancient history forever. But I mean, I think what's really intriguing about this is I am enjoying the Second Chronicles DLC for Age of Empires 2 so much. And just based off the little tidbit he gave of trying to like run for governor again in the Roman DLC or the Battle for Greece DLC that they've done, is like, I would totally go back and play that. And I'm excited to know, obviously Ben won't be able to tell us here, but what they would plan for Chronicles 3. Because when you look at the reception for these DLCs on YouTube as well, or like any of the official announcements from World's Edge or the Age of Empires franchise, the comments are all like, I heard this is the last Chronicles DLC. Is that true? Don't let that be the case. Or like, Chronicles 1 was amazing. And so they're really excited for this one. And so this one is such a blast of exploring Alexander's entire life, and like I said, the scenarios it puts you in, that I'm really interested to see like how, even just using the few tools they feel like they have at hand, what Chronicles DLC they try to make next. Because I mean, as for Ben, if he wants to go off and take his same design philosophy and work on any other strategy game, that sounds good enough for me to follow and try it out, because his approach already to trying to like infuse the narrative to the gameplay is exactly what a lot of these strategy games were missing, and that's what we were talking about before.
Nice. Okay, then a question for you, Ben. You have unlimited budget and you have access to every IP possible. What game are you making next?
There's a temptation to do, I guess, Red Alert 4. Red Alert 2 is one of my favorite RTS campaigns of all time. And it's just good fun. And Red Alert 3, I feel like they must have had unlimited budget. The cast of actors they had in there, Jonathan Pryce and J.K. Simmons, ridiculous. So I would quite like to dip my toes in there. That'd be amazing. Although I suppose that would entail working with EA. if I could do anything, though, I mean, I have all sorts of grand ideas for strategy games. So one of my favorite RTS games ever is Rise and Fall Civilizations at War. I don't know if you played it. It's kind of Age of Empires-esque. It had this gimmick, which is hero mode, where you press F1 or whatever it was on your keyboard, and then you get to control your hero sort of mountain blade style and run around, and it's sort of hack and slash for a bit. That's what people remember it for. But actually, it was fantastic 3D RTS on a huge scale, like the massive walls, and you could get units of, you know, hundreds and hundreds of men, not quite Total War level, but large. And I really feel like that game was a sort of hint as to where RTS could have gone if the genre hadn't died or gone into hibernation, as it were. And of course, Rise and Fall, if you know anything about the development of that game, basically got shut off before they'd finished making it. So it came out and it was a pretty janky game, as much as I love it. So I feel like if I could sort of take a massive budget and make the next RTS game, it would involve a game on that kind of scale, where you have a kind of Age of Empires style resource gathering, base building, but then you have, you know, armies on the size approaching sort of Total War thing. As for the narrative, I think it'd be interesting to create a very new kind of fantasy setting. I'm not someone who's into sort of typical high fantasy, orcs and elves and all that sort of thing. But another one of my favorite RTS games, Rise of Legends, if you ever played that, where it's really creative. They had the sort of steampunk Renaissance Italy faction, and then they had the sort of djinns and genies, sort of desert Arabian Nights, that kind of Eastern mythology faction. And then there was, I don't even know how you describe them, sort of Mesoamerican space laser aliens. Three really creative, weird factions. And I would like to explore creating a setting which sort of maybe historically inspired, but is, you know, visually very unique. And of course, that opens up any number of design possibilities that you want.
Yeah, I find that really fascinating. Then at the same time, sometimes the limitations is where creativity takes over sometimes, which I guess is true for Age of Empires 2 DLC, for example, or a budget limit sometimes, or time limit or something like that. But I suppose there's a good balance between limitation and freedom.
Historical limitations often get us, and particularly because I am so set on historical authenticity and really trying to recreate the events that we have. So all of the scenarios are based on, you know, real events. We can't just make something up. So it can't just be that we come up with I've got a great idea for a level and it's going to be like a tower defense game in Age of Empires. Well, we can't just do that, because what we actually do is take the historical event first and then think, how do we represent that through gameplay? And that can be quite limiting sometimes. Sometimes the geography can be quite limiting. It's like, can we really just change this coastline as we need it? You know, sometimes we have to make judgment calls there. But from a design point of view, history is also quite useful in the very basic way, where kind of people understand what a sort of knight should do, what an archer should do, what a spearman should do. Whereas obviously if you're creating a fantasy game, or particularly a sci-fi game, you sort of have to teach people what the counter systems are and what the function of each unit is, because it's not necessarily visually obvious unless you're very clever about it.
Yeah, I find that interesting also how some of the other games approach this. For example, what you described with cutscenes, I found this a lot more in a game like Empire Earth. But still, I found like it worked there. Like, I thought the voice acting was done really well. Even if the sound in general was kind of bad, the voice acting was done really well. And I found the campaigns really interesting, even though they were also a mixture of historical and fantasy in a way. Like, not fantasy, but like ahistorical. And then you have something like, I don't know if you played Total Annihilation and Total Annihilation Kingdoms. Did you play both of those?
Yeah.
What did you make up of? Okay, Total Annihilation comes out. It's received very well, but then criticized for not having much story in the campaign. And then they go all in on story, and then they flop massively.
I wouldn't necessarily say it was going all in on story that caused Kingdoms to flop. It was such a strange game.
It was.
In some quite wonderful ways. I mean, you know, talking about a slightly different twist on fantasy, I thought TA Kingdoms was very distinctive and memorable. And mm-hmm. I
absolutely remember
some things and some quite asymmetric factions with these sort of beast tamers and all this stuff. I thought it was wonderfully creative. I think it was the execution that was the problem. I remember even as a kid playing that thinking, this is janky.
Yeah, but then was the focus on the story what created that jankiness then? I don't know.
I don't know how the production went. So maybe if you're talking about allocation of resources, but I think in general, do you have to choose between focusing on story or focusing on gameplay? I think absolutely not. And I think that
depends on your budget.
Sorry?
It depends on your budget, I guess.
It does depend on your budget. But often, I mean, especially in the modern gaming industry, there are specialist narrative designers, there are specialist writers, you know, there are people like me. The fact that I'm also involved in design stuff is a little odd, but generally speaking, you know, it'll be a completely separate set of people working on the story, working on the design. So you don't necessarily have to split your manpower in order to achieve those things. And I think what people don't realize about narrative design is that it goes a lot beyond just coming up with the story that you might tell through cutscenes and dialogue. It infuses every aspect of the game. It's the flavor of the units. It's, you know, that world building seeps into the visual designs of units. You know, narrative designers are often in close communication with the artists to make sure that these things visually represent the story of the world as much as possible. And I think that so many of our most beloved RTS games, it's those beautiful little details that come out and where you can really tell someone has created an interesting world, that I think you can't do without it.
I think the biggest alternative to that is a sandbox game, right? Like a sandbox strategy game where you create your own story, like the Total War series or the Paradox games.
Yes, where it's sort of an emergent narrative. I mean, these are sort of story-heavy games in as much as the story emerges from your own actions. I'm a huge Total War fan in particular. I think up there with Age of Empires is my favorite series ever. I play a lot of Football Manager, and again, like a story emerges from you're just playing with a bunch of menus. It's a fantasy that occurs inside your head. But even there, I think that there's so much delightful flavor and detail. People remember from Medieval 2 Total War, you know, the general speeches that you can listen to before the game, the little videos that play when you send an assassin and he's either successful or unsuccessful and you see him, you know, falling out of a window or something. So people really remember these little moments of delightful world-building detail that you throw in. I've often thought about sort of what I would do to as a narrative designer on something like Total War or even Football Manager. And I think one of the key things, which I think particularly these bigger Paradox games with many, many systems do quite well, is to have the world sort of feed back to you and make clear that it's responding to what you're doing. If you think about like in the Civilization games, where occasionally you'll get that little pop-up that comes up, you know, the top 5 cities in the world that we all love to visit, just gives a little hint that there's this big world that you're a part of. I think the more sort of feedback and reactivity that you can give to the player, the more that you can help them to create their own stories.
Yeah, there's a big interaction going on, and that's the power of the medium of the video game as opposed to a movie or a book. Your actions interact. That creates a lot of difficulty though oftentimes with like branching storylines that you have to make them come back again if it's that sort of interaction, which can have a lot of difficulty, and then having a linear campaign I imagine makes that much easier.
I say that we had some thinking about this because we introduced something called persistent choices in our campaign in Chronicles. Previously, you know, every single Age of Empires scenario in a campaign is just separate, self-contained experience. We introduced this system where you could make decisions in one level and you would see the consequence in a later level. And we did have to make the call about whether, how far do you go with this? Can you actually branch off the campaign and change it that significantly? Going back to what you were asking about before with production considerations and cost, creating a whole nother level that only 50% of the players are actually going to play was unconscionable with the constraints that we had. But also it creates all sorts of weird problems because of the nature of this genre. People expect, unlike, say, in an RPG where you have one save file and you just play through, this is discrete levels. So you can go back and play level 2 or go back and play level 3 and jump back in time, as it were. So you deal with the classic time travel problem, the grandfather paradox. You know, if you go back in time and then create different choices, but then go back to play the latest level that you've unlocked, your head starts to explode. So it's actually very complex.
Okay, so you mentioned recreating history and authenticity, as well as some new fantasy ideas. I guess, going back to history has its benefits and drawbacks. And then going to fantasy or something, you have to create everything from scratch, which again has its upsides and drawbacks. Do you have a story in you that you want to tell? Is there a untold story that you want to show the world?
I'm not going to spill the details of the stories that I have in my head, but I will say that whatever I will do will be much like Chronicles, in that it will be very character focused. That's the big thing for me. I really care about strong, distinct characters. And I care very much about the English language, the sentence, strong dialogue where people actually say interesting things in interesting ways. I think that's something where, for all the advancements in narrative in the industry over the last couple of decades, I still think that at the level of the sentence, there is work yet to be done to take it beyond cliche. So that's something that I care very much about. And also part of my little personal crusade is very sort of British, dark, dry humor. as opposed, because the industry is so American and everything sounds so American. I think a plethora of different voices is a great thing to have.
I love everything you're saying there.
So going back to the point about historical authenticity, it's always been a point of wonder for me. I just spent a really long tirade talking, just hyping up this DLC for everybody. But how do you even begin when World's Edge approaches you to know what the next Chronicles is going to be? I mean, you chose Battle for Greece and then you chose Alexander the Great. And it's less about what time period, like how do you decide what Chronicles 3 would be and more about where do you start? I mean, do you go to your personal collection of Aristotle's first editions, or do you just use your general knowledge from your PhD to map out what you think this campaign should be?
Well, I don't get to make the decision. Ultimately, World's Edge does get to make the decision. There was an idea right from the start that this would be a continuous narrative, chapter by chapter. And so the Battle for Greece DLC, which started with the Persian Wars into the Peloponnesian Wars, that seemed a pretty logical place to start. That's kind of the start of the classical era. And then Alexander the Great seemed, the very logical next step, and no objections from World's Edge there, because it's Alexander the Great, you know, everyone's heard of it. And I had sort of mapped out all the potential possible future DLCs. And the thing is, there's just so many of them. And that's another interesting thing about doing history. Lots of people know a little or sometimes a lot about history, and they have their own particular favorite figures and periods and events, and they want to see that. And it's going to be impossible to please everyone, because if we fully covered everything that happened in classical history, we would never stop making these DLCs. I would die of old age by the time we got to the Punic Wars or whatever. But ultimately, yeah, the next DLC, it's the publisher's decision. I guess they're a publisher, so it's primarily driven by what they think the community will want and what will sell.
And then I guess in that case, moving on to the design discussion, I found this DLC particularly difficult. I mean, I played on moderate, which is a step above standard. And I think as a player, my mindset going into the first scenario for Alexander was trying to play the game like Age of Empires 2. And Tim is primarily multiplayer, and I play primarily multiplayer in many other strategy games. But when it comes to AoE, I usually do play single player against other AI. I don't have friends interested in going back to that. So when I got there, I was trying to build buildings. I was trying to like master my resources. But the thing is, I was just constantly getting destroyed by the skirmishes popping up, and I was having to restart the scenario multiple times until it felt like I went down a semi-linear specific strategy path of just producing mass producing units as much as possible. And what it made me think of was an approach that most multiplayer AoE players have, where they deprioritize the city building aspect of Age of Empires and they prioritize the unit mass production, and almost like a min-maxing idea of how to obtain resources in this way with this many settlers and then produce this specific unit to counter whatever their enemy is. And that's what it kind of felt like for this Chronicles DLC. And I think that's particularly cool because we talked before about how there's like a difference in the strategy or the single player appeal versus the multiplayer appeal. And I feel like a single player AoE player coming into this DLC is going to be met with like a multiplayer adjacent gameplay loop of mass producing their units and focusing on that for their objectives rather than like absorbing resources and building the proper buildings and building the right upgrades. So I guess my question to you is, with all of that, is was that intentional? Did that just come about because of the narrative and design choices where you had to limit the player and make sure they followed the narrative? So it just, I mean, it's a battle. You're supposed to mass produce your units.
This is a very interesting topic. Difficulty and how much the experience can change depending on the difficulty level, because our difficulty levels aren't simply, you know, you'll get 20% more for each difficulty level you go up. It's a very different experience. So standard, which is annoyingly named because standard is easy, but the name standard makes it sound as if that's the default level everyone should be playing at. No, standard is easy, and there we expect players to have a pretty chill time. There's not too much pressure. We give you what you need to fend off the initial attacks. You can build up at your own pace. Anyone should be able to play it. And then we sort of have a story mode for like people who are really, really bad as well. And then moderate, we conceive of as basically the slightly chilled version of hard difficulty. The idea is it's kind of hard difficulty, but you don't have to be a sweaty micro nerd. I'm the main moderate player, basically. And once I tick off this is suitable for moderate, that's our standard. So you have me to blame for your constant restart. I'm afraid. But we actually sort of do more than just give the AI different amounts of resources or make them train more units on different difficulty levels. There are things like, there's one level where you have to capture multiple river crossings. And you'll have to capture more of them and hold them simultaneously on the higher difficulty levels, because lower difficulty players find it hard to multitask. So we can't ask them to look in multiple locations at once. You just can't ask them to do that. And we factor that into the design. There'll be levels where on lower difficulties, you'll have more stone available for you so that you can put down walls, you can put down castles. And that basically automatically takes care of your defense for you. And we know that lower level players want to play that way. For hard players, stone will just be removed from the map the moment the scenario starts, so that you actually have to produce your units and it's quite hectic and intense because that's the experience that they want.
Oh, wow. I love that. I did not know that, and I really appreciate that.
I suppose what made it really interesting for me was that going into moderate, to expand on my thought process for it, I was expecting and was initially disappointed in the idea of like what you would refer to as a ludonarrative dissonance of this is a battle where Philip is fighting and you're able to witness the battle at the top of the map. And then I'm going to sit here and play Age of Empires 2 in my corner as Alexander and build a town, build walls and everything. And so, you know, it obviously Alexander across his campaign, you know, established multiple cities with the same name as him. And so it's not completely ahistorical for him to have built a city or established a settlement during the course of his campaign or throughout his battles. But to me, it was like a dissonance between, you know, the implication of going to war and then playing Age of Empires 2 in the corner. But then what I was surprised by, and what I think other players would be surprised by, was the way it broke that gameplay loop. And then I felt like, oh, well, so I am in a battle, and the developers want me to just forget about building, like, castles or anything, and they want me to, you know, immediately mass produce, like, the proper cavalry units or anti-cavalry units in that way. And so whenever I would have to restart, it would generally be things like, now that I know that situation and I understand what I'm going to run into, I failed, let me strategize and start producing archers, which I had not done up until this point for this scenario. And so I suppose that's the part that's really intriguing. So you're mentioning taking away resources from the other difficulties or providing resources to the enemy AI on lower difficulties or on higher difficulties and things like that. And so I guess that's just what was really surprising was, like, historically, it makes sense that they might be able to build wooden walls because it's something they did in multiples of, like, many of the battles across this campaign. But establishing stone walls, building castles is not something you would have expected. And so it felt like moderate was, like, the normal approach difficulty to me. It was just, I was unprepared for the gameplay loop that was going to be asked of me to forget everything I knew about Age of Empires and play it through the eyes of, like, let me just actually mass produce units for this battle.
Hmm. Battles are interesting because to an extent it's Age of Empires 2 and you kind of have to accept that yes, the player, even though they're out in the middle of the desert, they can build a building and they press a button and a little unit walks out of that building because that's just how it works. You have to accept that they can age up. Like, what does that mean? If you're representing events that are meant to cover the course of like a single day, aging up, what does that, you just kind of have to put it out of your mind somewhat. But we do try as much as possible to try and erase some of that ludonarrative dissonance. Pitched battles are a really interesting case study because we have all of Alexander's most famous pitched battles here. Chaeronea, the Granicus, Issus, the Hydaspes, and Gaugamela. And we've tried to approach these in different ways because pitched battles, tough to do in Age of Empires. The scale that it works at, much better for representing campaigns over the course of months or weeks. You can do it basically as a standard build and destroy in an area that looks like a battlefield. So that's what we did for Chaeronea on the third mission, where you're controlling one wing of the army, but you're basically playing a regular Age of Empires game, and it's just kind of this symmetrical two armies opposite each other setup. One thing we've done before is, so for the Battle of Marathon in Battle for Greece, for example, rather than actually spending most of the scenario fighting the battle, which is just a bunch of Greeks running down a beach, you spend the majority of the time gathering up the forces beforehand. So you're wandering around Attica, gathering up this army, and then there's a little battle at the end. So the battle isn't really the main point of the gameplay. We had a wave defense for Gaugamela. So you've got your base and you're producing units out of your base and there's just waves and waves of enemies coming at you. We thought that was a good way to represent the sort of the massive scale of Darius's army flooding towards you. We did in one occasion, if you've played up to scenario 7, the Battle of the Granicus, you fight across the Granicus River. We did that in a sort of Total War style. Total War, of course, being a game much better suited to directly representing a single battle. Where you don't build any buildings and you just control Alexander's cavalry on the flank and sort of flanking round. But you can't do that for every battle. That scenario lasts about 20 minutes. It's a pretty cool, experimental, exciting cinematic experience, but Age of Empires is fun. It has a great core gameplay loop, and we've got to have that in most scenarios.
Yeah, at the end of the day, it's a gamification, right? It's you're not actually reliving history. It's a gamification version. And I think you're absolutely right. The gameplay loop works. We've seen how popular Age of Empires 2 is in general still today after all these years. So it's for a good reason, I would say. All right. Was there something else that, you know, you would like to let our listeners know about, a project or some ideas or concepts you feel like the industry could benefit off, or anything you'd like our listeners to know?
I don't necessarily have a direct message to project to the community. I would like to raise awareness of Chronicles, because, you know, we think it's really great. The Age of Empires 2 community loves it, but it hasn't necessarily been marketed outside of that community. So we want people to know that, you know, if you're into single player campaigns, there's one here. It's, you know, cutting edge, different level design, variety of levels. If you're into narrative games, you know, you could play this on one of the easier difficulties and you can have an interesting narrative experience. If you like history, I think it stands up as a great piece of historical fiction. So, you know, we'd like to spread the word that even if you're not a sweaty Age of Empires nerd worrying about build orders, you can enjoy this campaign.
I absolutely agree. And I recommend it to anyone who enjoys single player strategy games. Jack?
Yeah, absolutely. I just spoke on the difficulty because as somebody, like, that was a warning for people who are used to Age of Empires and would have gone into this with the same mindset as me. I feel like when I read about this DLC on the Steam store page, I got a different impression, like it was just going to be a reskin of normal Age of Empires. And I guess that's what I went into it with. And I was really pleasantly surprised with the cutscenes, the narrative that I was immediately met with, and the fact that it challenged my programming as an Age of Empires player. So, I mean, absolutely. I'd recommend it to anybody if they just want more Age of Empires, like a game that they just genuinely enjoy playing and like the familiarity of. There's a lot of stuff that's new and different here, and the level of detail that are on the maps with the unique items and placements they've done for a little bit of like world building, or I suppose just flair across the map. All of that stuff is just super, super pleasant.
Yeah, and I think at the beginning of a conversation, you're absolutely right, Ben, when you said that it's something that's quite missing in RTS today, this narrative and character-driven story. And not only that, but I think the metrics in a lot of different games show it overwhelmingly that single-player campaign is where the majority of RTS gamers are interested in, even though I think the multiplayer community is way louder for probably obvious reasons.
You're absolutely right about that. And obviously I have some insights into the data from a game with a lot of players. And I can tell you, the majority of players who play the campaigns play on the standard difficulty, play on the lower difficulty, actually. And I can also tell you that there's a huge number of people that never touch multiplayer. There's a huge contingent of people that just play skirmish against the AI. They just set up a game against some bots and they play that.
Yeah.
Or they mainly play campaigns. But you are absolutely right that you don't hear very much from these people online, on the forums. They're the sort of silent majority, as it were.
Well, it makes sense, right? Like, imagine you're a typical introvert or typical extrovert, or you like engaging with people, or you like to do your own thing. I mean, that will influence these things, right? So, I mean, to me, it makes sense from that perspective. It's just, I think in the past, sometimes that was misunderstood a little bit. But yeah.
It's an interesting issue because, of course, trying to diagnose what happened to the RTS genre, where sort of mid-2000s, we had a glut of RTS games, almost too many. You know, a lot of mediocre RTS games that'd be sort of one every week and, okay, another Command & Conquer clone or whatever. But then, you know, why did the genre die? And I think part of the problem was publishers ignoring single player players, ignoring people that wanted a good experience in skirmish, and trying to make everything multiplayer first, trying to make the gameplay loop much faster, you know, ignoring the fact that some people like to play these games kind of like a city builder. I want to relax and take my time and have fun with it. No, everything's got to be fast. We've got to get into the action quickly. And so I think really, because if you want my opinion on the quote unquote death of the RTS genre, I think that it's an odd type of death where the audience never went away. People didn't move on to other genres. There wasn't anything that replaced RTS. The audience was always there and has always been there. And that's why we're starting to see a revival now, because that appetite for RTS games never disappeared. It's just that publishers wanted to greenlight things that they saw as more profitable. And that meant, you know, more multiplayer focused, trying to replicate the success of something like StarCraft II. And it ends up with things like, you know, Command and Conquer 4, where it's just this horrible bastardization of the genre. You're trying to appeal to a very small section of people and you don't even manage that.
I think that must have been the very first and only time that shareholder profit has ruined anything ever, right?
I know, it usually works so well for humanity, doesn't it?
Yeah, we actually discussed this a little bit both on the Heroes of Might and Magic episode that Adam and I did and the Sudden Strike episode that Adam and Sid and I did, where there's this time period all throughout, not even a time period, there's just a history of video game development, especially from the early 2000s, like you're referring to with RTS, but even turn-based, where as they follow the similar trends of the larger video game industry at large, and especially with the two series that I just mentioned for the episodes dedicated to them, it was like an exploration of the fact that Heroes of Might and Magic is quite popular. It's not specific to just Poland. It's a historically significant strategy franchise that in 2015 had its last installment, and it was largely neglected and received poorly because its developer and publisher at the time, Ubisoft, was just far more interested in chasing the larger trends of strategy at the time. And it's similar to Sudden Strike. I mean, the last Sudden Strike game came out in 2015, and even though Sudden Strike 4 did better, or maybe 2017, but even if it did better, you're seeing almost a decade between these installments because of both development timelines and the fact that the audience has always been there, but trying to appease the larger industry trends is going to always affect these franchises. And so I think what's significant about that is the larger narrative here that includes your team and the work they've done for Age of Empires 2, because I've mentioned this so many times on this podcast, but Age of Empires 2 is very similar to something like StarCraft 2 in its significance, where so many successful game developers or CEOs of larger AAA companies, they specifically reference Age of Empires 2 and StarCraft 2 being influences on their career trajectory, even if they don't make games or produce content within that genre. So it's so significant as a milestone for RTS, Age of Empires 2 was, that for it to not only have been revived on its own in some way, or rather just upgraded, refreshed with a definitive edition, and the fact that World's Edge has such a strong viewpoint on wanting to maintain that and cooperate with the success or launch of Age of Empires 4 and then co-develop these things, and the fact that Age of Empires 2 is something that they're willing to invest time and money in and outsource to teams like yours to create content for, it's just really interesting. It's like at this point, it's clearly a staple of the strategy gaming sphere. But even if it wasn't a staple, it's made an impact. But doing this continues to have an impact on the trajectory of all of strategy. I mean, like we're saying, it speaks a lot that Age of Empires 2 is receiving content and receiving love in this way, not just because it was popular, but that you're also using that as a platform to try to push the larger narrative inclusion within strategy.
Mm. And I think it presents an interesting lesson to the rest of the industry, because why is Age of Empires 2 so popular? Why has it maintained that popularity? I think it had strong campaigns to draw in a bunch of people on release. I think that's a big reason why. But also it has a fun skirmish mode, it has fun casual multiplayer, and it has fun competitive multiplayer. you can play the game in a variety of different ways. It appeals to a variety of different audiences. And so, you know, that wide player base was always available to them. Obviously, the game and Ensemble Studios got shut down, and really the game was kept alive by the multiplayer scene for a long while, but also by the community creating, you know, community maps, community campaigns. Age of Empires 2 has that great accessible scenario editor. Other games like, you know, Warcraft 3, of course, is the best example of where user-generated content has given a game that came out a long time ago an incredibly long life. So I think that anyone sort of wanting to make a game today that has the lasting power that AoE 2 has, I think it needs to be able to be modded, and community members need to be able to create user-generated content. I think it has to appeal to a variety of different audiences, not just competitive people, not just campaign players. I think if you can sort of appeal to as many different people as you like, and players who even want to play the game in ways that you don't expect. Like I say, some people play Age of Empires 2 like a city builder, and that's kind of cute, and you might think that's a bit silly, but people love it. And if you can accommodate that rather than, you know, rejecting these people, then you create something that's going to become beloved, and you can create content for it for years and years after.
Absolutely. I love that. Okay, I think we're good to wrap this up. Ben, this was an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you so much for having me.
Jack, I think we both learned a lot. Thank you also for joining me in this interview.
No problem. Thank you for having me, and it was a pleasure to be able to come on and talk to Ben and learn more about this, like, look into the window of Age of Empires 2's life right now.
All right. And then, yeah, most of all, thank you to listeners at home tuning in, joining us every week. Again, thanks, guys. This has been wonderful. And yeah, have a good one.